Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of March. We are still trying to track our guest for this hour, who should be with us momentarily, at least I hope. Our guest, Ayan Hirsi Ali, and her book is Infidel. She is the Somali-born former Dutch parliamentarian who came to international attention following the murder of her colleague, Theo van Gogh, with whom she made the movie Submission, which criticized Islam's treatment of women. A letter was pinned to van Gogh's chest with a knife threatening that she would be next, and this has compelled her to live under 24-hour police protection ever since. She is currently living in the United States, where she has been for not too long a period of time, since last fall, I believe. She is a resident fellow of the American Enterprise Institute. She has quite a life story. She earned a college degree in political science in the Netherlands, and she was born in Somalia in 1969, a child of a warlord who was conspiring against Somalia's dictator. As a girl, she was the victim of female genital mutilation. Evidently, her father was opposed to this, but her grandmother, for cultural reasons, believed that this is something that she should undergo. She was in the Muslim Brotherhood, and while she was in her early 20s, she was sent to Canada to marry a stranger. She was sent via Germany, and she just didn't want to do this. So she got in a train and went to Holland, where she sought out a relative in whom to confide and discovered that it was fairly easy to apply for asylum in Holland. So she did do that, and she received asylum there. And then she went to school, and her rise through Dutch society was quite swift. She got a political science degree. She joined a liberal think tank, and then she was quite willing to confront Islam, which got her elected to the Dutch parliament. She switched to a more conservative party, and she urged the Dutch and the West to speak openly to Muslims, to draw lines, to give courage to young women. And so this is just part of her life story. We're looking for her right now, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ayan in just a moment. We think we may have found her. Coming up tomorrow during this time period, let me just tell you as we're as we're awaiting her, Anne Lamott will be with us. She joins us about every 4 months or 6 months, perhaps. She has another book, and I know that many of you are great fans of hers. The latest book is Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. She is the author of Traveling Mercies and Operating Instructions. She is a former columnist for Salon Magazine and lives near San Francisco. And she writes essays that are mini-sermons, really. And she's just a really interesting person. She reminds us of what's important in life for readers who are trying to live a kind of faith that's centered on social justice, who are saddened at the state of our nation, and who feel mired in a world gone mad with war and with greed. She and her quirky, funny perspective are nothing short of salve for tired souls. The Los Angeles Times Book Review said that about her. So Annie Lamott will be with us tomorrow during this time period. And during the first hour tomorrow, we'll be speaking with Jeremy Scahill. He is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He is frequent contributor to The Nation magazine and a correspondent for Democracy Now! He has reported extensively from Iraq, the former Yugoslavia, and Nigeria. And he writes, we talked about this some at some length about a month ago. This particular book looks at the administration's growing dependence on private security forces and the efforts in Congress to rein them in. So he'll be talking about Blackwater, the first hour of tomorrow's program, which was founded in 1997 and has grown to become one of the most powerful private military actors on the international scene. So he chronicles both the foreign and the domestic reach of Blackwater, which came to our attention from Fallujah, where, as you'll recall, four of the men were ambushed and burned in the streets and hung from a bridge in an incident that really put Blackwater on the map. And he also looks at its expedition to the oil-rich Caspian Sea to set up a military base miles from Iran to New Orleans, where its forces patrolled the hurricane-ravaged streets, and also to, as Jeremy will say, the chambers of power in Washington, D.C., where Blackwater executives are welcomed as the new heroes in the war on terror. The Bush administration hails Blackwater as a revolution in military affairs. Others see it as a threat to American democracy. So we'll be interested in hearing what Jeremy has to say about this and what you have to say about it. It should be good hours tomorrow as well. So we're just waiting for our guest to call us, which I hope she does pretty soon, because this is one of the interviews that you need to have the guest for, and I'm just not sure where she is. But, you know, it's really a pretty remarkable story here. One of the reviewers of the books says that she has come off as brave and righteous and determined, that she might be a little bit more curious. She looks at the tenets of the Muslim faith and believes that a lot of it is just much too radical and needs to go through an enlightenment period. She does not look at, as one reviewer said, racism, which may play its head here. And among immigrants in Holland, unemployment is highest for Moroccans and for Turks, the largest Muslim groups, although their average level of skills is roughly the same as all the other immigrant populations. Could racism play into this? She doesn't ask that question. That's one of the critical reviews here, although for the most part, this has been called a riveting memoir that deserves a wide readership. Liberal readers may learn from her that the threat of Islamic terrorism is every bit as grave and real as the most vocal have claimed. Conservatives may learn how not to make it worse. She's adored by many on either side of the political seesaw, Western feminists, defenders of free speech, and the conservative American Enterprise Institute. It's been called neoconservative, the institute in that employs her right now. A spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations says she's just another Muslim basher on the lecture circuit. So she's going to be dialing in, we understand, just momentarily, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ayan, because she'll be provocative. There's no doubt about that. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And you can talk with her about her book. I'm sure that it's been out for a little while now. Some of you may have had a chance to look at it, or certainly you've seen her being interviewed. She's been doing a great deal of press the last few months, and has had, I think it's an understatement to say, one extraordinary life. The book looks at her personal history, but it also looks at the history of the militant Islamic movement throughout Africa and also throughout the Middle East. So she is with us now, thank goodness. Ayan Hirsi Ali, and the book is Infidel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we thank you so much for being with us, Ayan Hirsi Ali.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And I do apologize for calling in so late.
That's okay. I told a lot of your life story in that time. But you don't know what I said, but I think it was accurate. Yeah. Let's start with, and you write about this a lot at the end of the book, but let's start with the horrendous story that brought you to international prominence, and that's the film that you made about how Islam is treating women, and your director who was murdered, and it put a death threat on your head. And I know that you feel terribly about this, that in some sense you feel responsible, you felt guilty, that you felt that he should have had some protection, but he just didn't seem to want it. Can you talk about that incident, how the two of you made the film, and how it really changed your life?
We made the film. I met Theo van Gogh in a house owned by his friend, and his friend at the time in 2003 was making a documentary on me. And then a year later, he was insulted by a man from Lebanon, but who lived in Belgium, called Abu Jaja. And being a member of parliament, he called me to complain about that incident because he had been manhandled by what he called the goons of Abu Jaja.
Mm.
And it was then I said that I said to him, you are a filmmaker. Instead of being angry about this, maybe you could make some comedies about Islamic radicalism and Islamist intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then that he said, maybe you should then write me a script. And I told him I'm not a script writer.
Mm.
And after a while, I told him about a project that I was planning, an art project, which I called Submission, in which I presented four women, with one woman, a fifth woman in the middle, who would depict Quranic verses that that make the beating and cruelty, various cruelties to the Muslim women legitimate. And he said, well, I can make that into a film.
Hmm.
And that is how we got together and converted that project, the art project, into a film.
Mm-hmm.
It changed my life in the sense that after he was killed, I was moved by the Dutch protection, by the Dutch police who were protecting me from place to place, from several what they call safe houses, because at the time they did not quite understand exactly where the threat came from and how big it would be. But he could be killed, yes, because he had no protection, and I had been under police protection since 2002.
Mm-hmm. And you continue to live with what you call a fatwa on your head right now, still now, right?
Well, I don't call it that way. I just say the man who killed Théo van Gogh, Mohamed Bouyeri, did not issue a fatwa fast. He just decided on his own, and probably with the help of a small group of men, that by killing someone whom they perceive to insult the prophets, the Quran or Allah, that they themselves will go to heaven. And it's such men, and perhaps even women, that I fear.
Mm-hmm. So how does it affect your life at this point in time? Do you still have security around you? Do you have to live? I know you've had to go through more than your fair share of fear here, but are you fearful still?
I try to live without fear. I try to live within the parameters. Yes, I have security. I try to live within the parameters that the security men give me. And I can, within those parameters, I can work and live.
Let's talk about your earlier life. You're originally from Somalia. You are Somalian-born, former Dutch parliamentarian. You really have taken roots in so many different parts of the world. Tell me about your early years in Somalia, and tell me about your father.
That's almost half the book.
Right.
I would summarize my early life as one full of movement.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Somalia. I lived before age 10 in four different countries.
Mm-hmm.
Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya. The reason for all this moving was my father, who was a politician, and who, after 1969, when the country was overtaken by force by a man called Siad Barre, was put in jail. And after he escaped from jail, my father swore with more people like him to fight Siad Barre and to oust him. And they set up camp in Ethiopia. And I try to explain in the book that my father was so devoted to that cause that for him, wife and children came always on the second place.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in 1991, Siad Barre was ousted, but we did not get freedom as my father hoped for and democracy. But the country fell into civil war, and Somalia is still in that civil war.
Yes. Yeah, there was news of that this morning, actually. Compare, if you would, as you do in the book, you talk about a harsher, crueler form of Islam that you experienced as a child in Saudi Arabia than what you had experienced in Somalia. How was it different?
It was different because Saudi Arabia is governed by the Quran, or in according to the rules in the Quran, the Sharia or Islamic law. Even though 100% of Somalis are Muslims, at the time when we were growing up, there was no Sharia. It was a secular country. And it was bad enough living under the communists and lining up, queuing for food, and our houses being ransacked and my father being put in jail. But in Saudi Arabia, living under an Islamic theocracy is something that seeps into every day, into the everyday life, and almost every minute of every day. Most visible to a child my age at the time was this strict segregation of the sexes, where I played with my brother in Somalia, in Saudi Arabia. There was complete separation. Mm. He and my father could go out, and my brother, my sister, my mother, and I were restricted as much as possible to the house.
Mm-hmm.
Quran school in Somalia was mixed, boys and girls. In Saudi Arabia, it is boys only, girls only. Regular school is the same. Regular school in Saudi Arabia was almost, 80% of the curriculum was about Islam and religion. And it was just so all-pervasive. And my brother, even though I'm not sure he saw them, talked of every Friday when he and my father went to pray. At the end, there were the executions. And the people who wanted to go and be spectators as people were beheaded or hands were cut off or women were stoned could go and look at that and watch that. And that was not the case in Somalia, even though there was a lot of torture and a lot of execution being done by the government to dissidents.
Is that still happening today?
In Saudi Arabia, yes. Somalia is a total anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And much of Somalia, unfortunately, has not only slipped into anarchy, but many people believe that the way out and the way towards law and order is by introducing Islamic law.
When did you, I need an update on the relationship with your father. In the book, you talk about a conversation that lasted about an hour that you had with him. I believe it took place in 2003, and you haven't spoken since?
In 2004, in May 2004. That was before I made the film Submission. After I made the film, and after Theo van Gogh was killed, first it was almost impossible for me to talk to him, but any time I would call him, he would not pick up the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Or he would pick up and there'd be no sound and he would hang up.
And that's because?
Well, that is because I have, in his view, as in the view of many Muslims, I have insulted or I've blasphemed against God by taking verses from the Holy Quran and having those written on the bodies of women.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you feel stirrings that, you know, you wanted to break away from this, Ian? You just didn't feel comfortable with the whole thing. Was it after female genital mutilation that you thought this, perhaps, when you were, what, five? Or when did it happen?
Oh, no. When I was five, all the little girls of my age were either being mutilated or they would be mutilated. It wasn't really associated with Islam. No, not at age five. It
right.
was much, much later. It is when I turn 16 that I get a teacher who introduces me into the logic of Islam, and not only me, but some of the other students. And it's then that I notice inconsistencies. For example, it says in the Quran, almost in every page, that God is just. But then in the same Quran, men and women are unequal. Women are allowed, are subordinate. Men are allowed to beat them. So if I then just even thought loudly about it, or if I would ask this question, I would be accused of having Satan in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And the doubts continued, but I managed to suppress all doubts against Islam and the Quran and God and the Prophet Muhammad until the 11th of September 2001. It was then after that event that I was actually forced to sit down and think clearly about where I stood and what I thought of it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your arrival in Amsterdam. There was an arranged marriage. Tell me if this is an unusual thing to have an arranged marriage. Your father had set this up with some gentleman who lived in Canada. You go to Germany on your way to Canada, and you say, no, I don't think I'll go to Canada. I think I'll go to Amsterdam.
That is not unusual in the Somali or Islamic tradition.
Hmm.
That is, in fact, common. What is unusual is to run away from that or to argue with that tradition. And that is exactly what I do. After my father decides, and the man who is a distant cousin comes from Canada looking for his family and looking for a wife, and my father offers me to him. And because he lives in Canada, he has to go back. Immigration papers have to be arranged for me. At the time, it was difficult in Kenya. So an uncle in Germany offers to take me in and says, well, we can have the paperwork done here. It's then that I see a moment that I can escape, and I take the train to Holland. I ask for asylum, and I do not tell them in Holland that I'm running away from an arranged marriage or that I had lived in Kenya or that I was on my way to Canada. Mm-hmm. I pretend to be like one of the other people, Somalis, who are running away from the civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not uncommon. Again, what is uncommon is defying it and running away and actually surviving.
Right.
Yes.
Let's pause for a moment. We have a lot to talk about, but we need to take a short pause, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Ayan Hirsi Ali is our guest. Her book is Infidel. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Ayan Hirsi Ali. Her book is Infidel, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Let's talk about your getting elected to the Dutch Parliament and how you got elected. Your willingness, some people have said, to confront Islam is what got you elected to that position. Would you agree with that, Ayan?
Well, I would say to confront Islam in its treatment of women.
Mm-hmm.
It was a subject that was avoided by Dutch politicians and intellectuals. And it was after a man called Pim Fortuyn was killed in Holland. There was a lot of tension between Muslims and non-Muslims in Holland. And I had actually left Holland. I had come to the United States in 2002. And it was the Liberal Party that approached me and said, well, we think that the subjects you discuss, the position of women and also the relevance of Islam to whether Muslims assimilate into Dutch society or not, is very important, and we would like you to defend your ideas in Parliament. It was then that I joined and said yes.
Mm-hmm. And talk at greater length here about September 11th, 2001. A great deal of debate about the terror attacks, about who did these attacks, how big this radical form of Islam was in the world. You say that it really led to, it reignited an inner conflict that you had over religion. What were you thinking in those days?
Well, I think between 1992 and 2001, I was only concerned with my own assimilation and with my own relationship to God and to my parents and to trying to survive in Holland. And I had managed, each time there was a dissonance between the two, to ignore my Islamic upbringing and simply not think about it. All the people who surrounded me were Dutch friends, and it was easy for me to do that. What happens on the 11th of September, after that horrific event, is that the Western leaders call on all Muslims to stand up and say, this is not done in the name of my religion. It's then that I download all the literature and the propaganda written by bin Laden, and even the letter, which was printed in all the newspapers by Mohammed Atta, one of the leaders. And I compare them to what is written in the Quran and in the Hadith and find that that is very, very consistent. And what bin Laden and his followers are saying is, we are now engaged in a jihad. Islam is under attack by the West, by Americans and by Jews. Stand up and fight for it. And it's then that I decide to make up my own individual mind and come to the conclusion that it's all, the whole, this is religion being used as a source of power, of course, which religion has always been used as a source of power. But this time, my religion, my own upbringing, and that I came to the conclusion, I do not believe in a God who commands people to fly planes full of passengers into buildings full of people.
Mm-hmm. So is it your belief, would this be fair to say, that the attacks on the World Trade Center were not by a lunatic fringe, but by the core of Islam?
I think it's fair, 5 years onward, to say that we are no longer talking about a lunatic fringe. For if that were the case, then the whole problem would have been solved. But what we see is silence, a very loud silence, each time a terrorist attack is carried out in the name of Islam. And we see loud demonstrations calling for those who insult the Prophet to be killed when a dozen cartoons is drawn in an obscure paper in Denmark. And so this shows, and these are not just the two examples, but if you look at the number of conflicts today in the world, you will see that two-thirds of them, Muslims are involved somehow, either against other Muslims or non-Muslims, and it's all being fought in the name of Islam. And I think this just shows that it's not a lunatic fringe, but that it is in the heart of the religion.
Mm-hmm. And yet there have been many of the faith who would condemn those acts, don't you think?
Yes, there are individual Muslims who condemn these acts, who call for a reformation. They're very serious. One who springs to mind is Irshad Manji, who lives in Canada and who is busy trying to get as many people as she can, as many Muslims as she can, together to try and remain faithful, but at the same time reform the faith. And I think that these people, these true dissidents, deserve all the support that they can get.
Mm-hmm. And what about the, certainly September 11 changed a lot of things in the world. What about what's happened as a result? We hear in the United States that actions that we have taken, particularly actions in Iraq, have really upset that whole region, that we have fueled more terrorism. Would you say that there's a case to be made there, and is there a connection at all with the Muslim faith here?
I think those who say that people like bin Laden would use any action by the United States and her allies in Muslim countries as an argument to convince more and more people that Islam is under attack, that they have a point. But the terrorist attacks and the determination of radical Muslims to create a global society based on Sharia has been there before the invasion of Iraq and will go on even if the United States troops leave Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the faith moving into the modern era, what kind of self-examination needs to take place? Is it first and foremost the treatment of women?
I think first and foremost, we need a process of individualization in the Muslim world. What we see now is men calling masses and masses of people, lumping them together as Muslims and saying, you must follow the Prophet Muhammad. I think Muslims must learn as individuals to follow their own reason. Then they must examine the concept of God, which is a relationship between the individual and God, which is one of master and slave. And if Muslims re-examine that, like Jews and Christians have done, and have a dialogue with God, then Muslim individuals will be able to reject people like bin Laden. And yes, the treatment of women and the turning of women into and treating of women like chattel, that is going to be the biggest struggle when it comes to modernity and reforming the faith and improving the lives of millions of people in Muslim countries, yes.
We're going to welcome phone calls in a moment. Tell me how you came to work for the American Enterprise Institute, Ayan.
I was introduced to the American Enterprise Institute and several other think tanks by a good friend of mine who used to be ambassador of the United States to the Netherlands. And after my citizenship was threatened to be taken away, the American Enterprise Institute jumped in and said they had already agreed to employ me and said, well, we can bring it forward. And they brought me to the U.S. in June.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry at all that you're now working for an organization that in America has been identified as an extremely conservative organization? Does it make what you're saying right now more difficult for people to hear?
Well, the American Enterprise Institute does not make it difficult for me to express my views.
Right.
They know I am a liberal, and they encourage my writing and my promoting, and in fact, the fight for women's rights. And I think there's a lot of unfair prejudice against the American Enterprise Institute. It's an independent think tank that tries to influence government. And I would say invite any of the people who are suspicious of the American Enterprise Institute to look at their website I don't think that you'll find anything extremely conservative in there. I would say moderately conservative.
Let's welcome phone calls, 800-486-8655. Our first caller is Ken from Stratford. Hi, Ken.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Ken.
Tom, actually.
Who?
Tom, not Ken. That's all right. I appreciate Ian's work and her presence in this talk. Thank you. I wonder if she has read Jimmy Carter's book on Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, and what she thinks about that.
I have to admit that I have not read Jimmy Carter's book, and therefore I cannot give you a good opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid.
But what about attempts to get sides together? Condoleezza Rice, we talked some about this last hour, is trying to jumpstart a peace process here. Would you agree that when it comes to a source of discontent among many in the Arab world, that a lack of attention to the Palestinian-Israeli issue is one of the reasons there's discontent, a major reason there's discontent?
I would say that if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is presented as that, as what it is, then a peace process has a chance, because it's territorial conflict between two small groups of people on a world scale. But the problem between the Israelis and Palestinians for the last 50 years has been presented as a conflict between Jews and Muslims. And in Muslim lands, a systematic propaganda has been fed into populations ruled by tyrants, that unless that conflict is resolved, the hidden assumption is unless Israel is wiped off the map, there will be no peace. And I think only if those populations are informed again and again and it becomes a territorial conflict, only then will a peace process have a chance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Tom. And let's go next to Diane from Pewaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hello. I just wanted to give Ian a hug, an embrace over the phone, because I feel for her in the situation of being estranged from family, from culture, from land, the land she grew up in. And I just want to say that that when people are prophets, that they experience this kind of pain and disassociation, and I just want to definitely give her my support and my positive energy, anything I can send to her, that she continues to speak from her heart.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you very, very much.
Do you consider yourself a prophet?
No, I don't. And I'm very suspicious of prophets and people who call themselves or consider themselves prophets. I consider myself as one born into Islam and who thinks by asking the right questions I can contribute to that individualization process which I talked about, and hopefully one which women will take on because they have the most to gain by.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a terribly general question, but you can take this wherever you want. What do you make of America?
I love America, and I think that in a unique way in history, America is not—it's not an ethnicity, it's not a religion. America is a concept, and it's a concept of freedom. And America has all its faults, and it's not perfect, but it is the best concept of freedom that has ever been organized into a functioning country, nation, and empire even.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what I think of America.
Mm-hmm.
But all we can do is continue to criticize those American leaders, not out of spite, but so that they can continue to try and promote freedom both here and elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
the freedom of the individual.
Tell me the kind of response you've had, particularly from Muslim women, and maybe it varies from country to country. Have people kind of rallied to you and to your statements about this, longing for modernity, longing for a change in the treatment of women. Have you been blasted and your thoughts have been blasted by others? Who's resonating with what you're saying?
There are some Muslim women, very few, who call me, who email me, who let me know that they appreciate what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Often they say, because you have bodyguards, you can say what you can and you can go out there and voice our thoughts, and we don't. And we appreciate that you're risking your life in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of Muslim women who have taken the trouble to get in touch with me have blasted me, have criticized me, and the main point of their criticism is do not link any negative attitude or anything they consider negative to Islam. Islam is perfect. The Prophet Muhammad is perfect. The Quran is perfect. And stay out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that because I think for many women, the source of their oppression is also the God to whom they turn for comfort. And so unsettling that is not going to earn me flattery.
We'll welcome more phone calls in just a moment at 800-486-8655. Ayaan Hirsi Ali is our guest, and we're talking about her book, Infidel, and her remarkable life. Born in Somalia, lived in Saudi Arabia, the child of a warlord who was conspiring against Somalia's dictator, victim of female genital mutilation. We have yet to talk about her time in the Muslim Brotherhood. She, because of her father's politics, spent some time in Saudi Arabia as well, had an arranged marriage, was supposed to go to Canada, marry this guy, gets off, gets on another train when she's in Germany on her way to Canada and goes to Holland and becomes a member of the Dutch Parliament, partially because of immigration issues, does a film. And the director is murdered. You remember this story. And she is now living in the United States and working with the American Enterprise Institute. So more calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now and to Joan from Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
Two unforgettable Somalis, the first that my husband and I ever met, came to us in 1979 or 1980, and one who is now deceased knew five languages and used to argue with my husband in English about alcohol and other topics in the neighborhood. They're both unforgettable. One is here in Milwaukee and has a nightclub, and I remember him saying that his mother was probably already a leader in her village and was hoping for democracy and to get into politics, his mother. And that in 1979 or 80, these guys were still, they were talking already about maybe not anarchy, but no real government in Somali. And they became very close to our hearts, and I only remember those two.
Mm-hmm. Ayaan?
Yes, and I think there are many, many Somalis like those two who, in the early 1970s and in the 1980s, left Somalia for the United States, for Canada, for the UK, even for Australia. And because of that brain drain, of course, strengthened by the brutal dictatorship of Siad Barre, we were, like your friend predicted, heading towards anarchy and the entry of radical Islam as the only solution to political and social problems faced by Somalis, and that's a tragedy.
And thanks very much for your call. Tell me about the conversation, the self-examination of Islam, the move to modernity. Where is it happening now? Who is responsible, do you think, for having that conversation, Ayaan?
It's always been happening, but it's always been subjugated. People in Islam, from its inception, who asked questions, were silenced. they were silenced because they were considered sinners. Doubt is considered to be a disease. And many of them did not live long enough or did not live, they did not leave behind work that influenced many Muslim minds, as we can see in Europe, for example. Today, the Muslim dissidents who want genuine change, and those who want genuine change are those who will say the Quran is not the word of God, but it's written by human beings. The Prophet Muhammad is not infallible and should not be followed as a moral guide in the 21st century, but he should be questioned and some of his choices should be refuted. Those individuals you will find in Europe and in the United States, because in these open societies, freedom of expression exists.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dana next from the Fox Cities. Hi, Dana.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm just curious to hear what Ian has to say about organizations like Women for Women International and different charity organizations that try to connect American women with women in third world countries and the Islamic world by donations and corresponding with each other, if she thinks that's an effective way to promote change and show women that there is options and different ways of living, what, if she's heard about those organizations and what she thinks.
Yes, I've heard of these and other organizations, and I think that they will be effective if they do not avoid the subject of Islam. And many Western organizations are forced, when in Islamic countries, to adapt to the dictates of Sharia. For example, they will allow women to be merchants, to trade, because the Prophet of Muhammad's first wife was a trader. But then she will have to always ask, within the Islamic context, she will need to ask permission of a guardian, whether it's her father or her husband and so on. And so as long as these Islamic laws and Islamic doctrines that hold women down are not addressed, the change is going to be it's going to be very, very slow and very, very painful.
Thanks, Gina, for your call. Jane is next from Waukesha. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I read your book, Ayan, and I am honored to be able to speak with you. I am so impressed with you, with your intellectual honesty, with your courage. I can't say enough about you. I read your book. I was very impressed, and I have your other book on order now. I want to learn more. But what can ordinary people do? What can we do to help increase awareness of this? How can we make change happen?
I think all ordinary people who are interested in this subject can help by making a distinction between Islam as a set of beliefs and Muslims as individuals to whose reason they can appeal. And when you make that distinction, please try and allow yourself not to be inhibited by what is now politically correct to do, which is to consider the violence and the subjugation of women and the inhumanity that we see as being only a characteristic of a fringe part of Islam, but that it is at the heart of Islam, and it is having this constant dialogue with Muslim individuals and putting to them questions, moral questions, for example, on the choices the Prophet Muhammad made, that will, I hope, induce them, provoke them to answer those questions in a way that is compatible with human rights and will bring about this change, which is going to take generations anyway.
Well, this has to happen within the Muslim community, doesn't it? If you're Jewish or if you're Christian or whatever you are, you can't really take on the Muslim faith and say, hey, you guys, let's reexamine the way you treat women.
Well, that was before the 11th of September. That was before globalization. But now, as we have come to live in the world, and also especially in liberal societies where millions and millions of Muslims immigrate to or want to immigrate to, trying to run away from tyrants, it is no longer possible to draw these lines between Jewish communities and Muslim communities, or Christian communities and Muslim communities, or secular communities and Muslim communities. We share this world, we share this society, and I think that we have to see each other not as members of groups, but as individuals who can converse with each other and change each other's minds as individuals.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Abdul from Milwaukee. Hi, Abdul.
Yes, how you doing? I want to ask, I'm from Africa anyway, but I want to know, she's a Muslim. She talk about a lot about Islam, but I think what she talk about right now, they have not to do with Islam. Maybe they have something to do with what she's from in Somalia. And I want to know if she's Muslim or not.
Are you Muslim or not?
I was born and raised as a Muslim, but have chosen after the 11th of September not to be a Muslim. I've consciously chosen that, because that means if I remain a Muslim, I will have to follow the instructions that are laid down in the Quran. Is it Islamic? Well, it is in the Quran that women should be obedient and men should beat them. It's written in the Quran that infidels should be chased and killed and their property taken away. And people like Bin Laden, who's gathering a large following day by day, is actually acting on these Quranic edicts, and it is to people like the caller of today who, if they want to remain in the faith, like Irshan Manji suggests, to then pose those questions and rethink and review the Quranic commands.
And why do you think Bin Laden is gathering more followers now?
Well, because he has consistency on his side. If he tells people who call themselves moderate Muslims, you to be a Muslim, you must obey what the Prophet said, what is written in the Quran, and he presents them with that, then many Muslim individuals find it difficult to argue with him. And I think true change will take place when they acknowledge that all that Bin Laden is saying is in the Quran, but that is information from 1,400 years ago, and that as individuals, Muslims are capable of reviewing and changing and refuting those commands.
Mm-hmm. Just as it would be the case in a lot of other faiths' holy books, as in the Bible, which can be interpreted in so many ways, or the
exactly
or the Torah. Uh-huh.
Exactly, as many Christians and many Jewish people have done.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and but that is what is seen by many Muslims as blasphemy. And I think that it is time that we blaspheme, because the enlightenment process cannot begin without blasphemy.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting statement. Thanks, Abdul, for the call. John from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I'd like to get your guest's opinion on what the status of women were under Saddam Hussein prior to the U.S. invasion in comparison to other Islamic countries in the area, and then contrast it to what she believes or what her opinion is in comparison to what it is today.
I have not been in Iraq myself, but I read a lot about Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and I actually got involved in the making of the Iraqi constitution, not by making it myself, but by writing an article in which I said it was not proper to have in the Iraqi constitution that laws cannot be made unless they meet, unless they are coherent with Islamic law, because that will affect women negatively. In which case you will get a situation where women would have more rights under Saddam Hussein than under the constitution of the interim devised by the interim government in the United States. And I know that if that is in the constitution, the same goes for Afghanistan, that will affect women in a horrible way.
How did they compare to other Islamic countries in the area prior to the invasion? Was Iraq better or worse than some of the countries in that area?
Well, when I talk to my Iraqi friends, they tell me Iraq was bad for both women and men. But women were allowed to go to school, attended universities, served in the army, and were just as much either victims or oppressors as men. After the Iraqi constitution was passed, which is just a year or two ago, it's just too difficult to say exactly how their lives are. But many Iraqi women say that they now have to live under the dictates of Sharia, which is far worse, because that affects your daily life. It affects matters of Even leaving the house, you have to ask permission for your husband. You have to, you get disinherited. You get, your testimony is worth half of only that of a man, which in a country that is in war, when rape takes place, women will not get defended because they have to, you know, fight, stand up to their rapist.
Mm-hmm.
And their testimony is only worth half of that of the rapist. And matters of divorce. So there can be, I think, today nothing worse in terms of legislation for a woman than Islamic Sharia. And that's what is assumed in the constitution of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Ayan, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, too. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Ayan Hirsi Ali, her book is Infidel, and it has recently been published in by the Free Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios, and thanks, everybody, for your calls. We could have gone hours on this subject. There's no doubt about that. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.